I don't know, you women get all the good shiurim. I don't know what it is. Okay. Anyway, today's shiur is dedicated by Bela Kalmanson, a new Ole, in memory of the fourth yahrzeit of her mother, Chaya Sora Shmuel Yaakov, Shirley Brin Kalmanson, and we hope that the Divrei Torah should be Le'iloi Nishmata in Gan Eden. I would also, if I could put in a bit of a personal request, my landlord, who is really a truly, truly righteous person who's done numerous chasadim for me and for many, many people in Malo Dafna, unfortunately had a very, very serious stroke, and I hope he could be mispalo for a refuah shleima for Mordechai Ben Sora. And he has many, many chusim, and we hope that those chusim and our tefilas will help him. We are looking at Mishlei, and again, we will eventually, I do promise you, B'li Neder, of course, that we will get into a written text, but there is indeed a lot of introductory material that you need to understand in order to appreciate the overall book of Mishlei. Derech Agav, though, I want to skip ahead many, many centuries, because we got into this last week. Shlomo HaMelech uses the word musar quite a lot, and musar means chastisement. Musar actually means afflicting yourself, but that doesn't mean, not in the sense of rolling in the snow or sleeping on nails. That is not what the musar is, but it's kind of a moral affliction in which you engage in a process of introspection. You evaluate not only the sins that you commit, that we commit, but even the good deeds that I acted l'shem shemayim. Right, so musar involves scrutiny. Basically, it is not based, but it's the same idea that Socrates expressed, lahavdil, many havdalas, that the unexamined life is not worth living, that a person must examine, a person must go through cheshbon ha-nefesh. Now, we're going to see that as great a person as the Chazon Ish was not always in favor of this type of scrutiny, because the Chazon Ish felt it could lead to depression, and for certain personalities, an obsessive compulsiveness that might be counterproductive. So it's very, very fascinating as to what are the techniques, but we know that Mishlei, of course, is the book of Tanakh that is devoted to midos and character and the like. And I just want to mention that there are five central points. I mean, the Vilna Gaon makes probably 3,000 points in his interpretation of Mishlei. But there are five central points in the book that one needs to be aware of, which are kind of the foundation. Principle one and two, we looked at last week, just to reiterate them. Principle one, the very purpose of our life on earth, the Vilna Gaon says, the reason why Hashem put us in this world is to rectify, to be misaken, to repair the negative midos that we have within our character. And the Vilna Gaon says, if one does not strive to rectify those midos, his language is, Lama li chayim. Why is there life at all? The Vilna Gaon did not say the purpose is to learn Torah. He didn't even say the purpose is to do mitzvah. The purpose is to be misaken midos. The Torah we learn, the mitzvahs we do, are mechanisms that assist us in that process. But the actual goal of life is to rectify our midos in the best way that we can. That is principle number one. Principle number two almost moves in the opposite direction, but not really. And that is the verse we looked at last week, Chanoch lenar al pi darko, that a person must be trained according to their nature, and that is that the process of character development does not involve changing yourself, but it involves taking the basic building blocks of your character and developing them in a positive way. This is the famous Gemara that the person that is born under the planet of Mars, which is the red planet, will have a teva, a nature to be shofech dam, to spill blood, will have a lust for blood. But he could choose to be a shochet, a mohel, or a murderer. Or a surgeon. Well, if they interpret it, umna. Yeah, umna can either be, different thing. Or a surgeon. Although I'm not sure if I want a bloodthirsty surgeon or a mohel for that matter, but okay. But be it as it may. Now, Whether we describe it as the constellation or we describe it as DNA, that really makes no difference, because the point basically is we are born a certain way. And the Vilna Gaon says, Chinuch is not about changing that basic structure, but enabling that structure to serve Hashem in positive and beneficial ways. This is the great mafteach, the great key to how we raise our children, how we teach our students, and how we deal with ourselves. You know, the child that has difficulty sitting still, whether hyperactivity is a condition or a midah, we don't have to get into that. But the way you raise that child is not by saying, you're going to sit 6 hours on this Shabbos table and don't move a muzzle. Yeah. That doesn't work. Now, maybe out of naked fear, the kid may obey, although that's not that likely today, even that. But kiyaskin, when he becomes older, when he's on his own, forget it. And therefore, the Gra says, in spite of the fact that the purpose of our life is to make our midos good, it's not so much to become a different person, but to take the parameters of our personality and use them in good and beneficial ways. Right, so that's principle number two. Principle number three, which is kind of a corollary, perhaps, and that is all spiritual change, the Vilna Gaon says, must take place gradually over time. And again, this analogy people make, whether it's dieting, whether it's exercise, all of these different things. You set tremendously difficult, high goals. What's going to happen is we're going to get discouraged. The person says, I will never say a word of Lashon Hara, never, ever, ever again. Well, you have to know, the Yetzer Hara is very powerful. As soon as a person says, never again, they immediately start to, you mean, not for 10 years, or 20 years, or 30 years, or Mirz Hashem, Meyev Yisrim Shana. That's a little difficult. That's overwhelming. I'll start tomorrow. Or a person says, I'll never eat chocolate again. Right? What's going to happen is, you will have an overwhelming, or I'll speak for myself, I will have an overwhelming urge to eat chocolate. But if a person says, you know, I don't have to eat it for the next 2 hours, Then I could tell myself, okay, in 2 hours, gonna have some good chocolate. But maybe after 2 hours, like, you know, I've gone this far, I can go a little further. These are mind games, indeed. But in the process of spiritual growth, you usually have to set small goals and stick with them. And then success builds on success, which is what Chazal say, mitzvah goreres mitzvah. The koach of a mitzvah leads you to another mitzvah. Right, so that's what the Vilna Gaon is very big on, the idea of not jumping to levels that are beyond you. Now, the truth of the matter is, it may be that certain schools of Hasidus very much took a different approach. It's an interesting point. Rav Tzadok, in a number of his writings, talks about the idea that sometimes you have to jump off the mountain. Just like the Jewish people for Kriyas Yamsuf, they had to jump into the sea. Or, you know, Nachshon ben Aminadav, it had to go up to his neck. You have to take chances. You have to go beyond what you think is possible. So there are different mahalchim, and maybe it depends on what the nature of the issue is. The Vilna Gaon perhaps was more of a cautious Litvisha personality, in which the Vilna Gaon said that long-lasting, enduring character transformation starts in small goals, as opposed to grandiose goals. Because the grandiose goal may be very, very exciting, but when we see that we're not able to sustain it, we give up. A small goal is maybe less elevating, so to speak, less inspirational, but since you can do it, so in effect you build yourself up la'at, 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 just like you want to run a marathon, right? So don't try to do it 26 miles the first day. Do it, you know, there are marathon runners who say that they were so much out of shape that they could not even run a block when they started. So they first have to walk around the block, and then eventually they can run more than 20 miles. So the truth of the matter is, as Eev said, Mipsari echaze eloka, from my flesh I see God, meaning the human body itself gives us analogies as to how we change our character and refine our midos and the like. But then, so I mentioned so far three principles, right? The purpose of life is to correct our midos. Number two, we have to work within our basic nature. Number three, we have to proceed gradually. But then he says a fourth principle, which almost seems to contradict the gradual approach. And based on a famous passage in the Rambam, right, they're very, very famous statement in the Rambam, which is actually borrowed from Aristotle. The Rambam was willing to use Aristotle, that ideally in character development we strive for the middle. One should not be selfish, one should not be overly generous, because then you're hurting your children, hurting your family. You need to have what is called the golden mean. But the Rambam says, if a person has gone over to a negative extreme on the other side, in order to reach the middle, you can't just go into the middle. It's like a tree, right? When a tree or a sapling, a young sapling, is totally bent over to the other side, in order to get the sapling going straight, you got to move it to the other side. So the Rambam says, if a person is, let's say, selfish and lacks compassion, in order to develop within his personality the attributes of kindness, he needs to go to an extreme. He needs to give more than the 10%. He needs to do more and more and more and more, with the idea that action will affect your character, which itself is very important. It's not that our actions are the outgrowth of our midos. Rather, the actions create the midos in and of itself. And although ideally you're supposed to reach a midpoint, but sometimes to reach the midpoint you need to go to the extreme as a temporary measure, and we have no real guidelines as to how temporary is temporary. And here is the interesting point. So on one hand, the Vilna Gaon espouses gradualism, and on the other hand, the Vilna Gaon espouses extremism. Now, those two words seem to be a little bit of a contradiction, because if you're doing things gradually, that means you're not going to extremes. But the short answer is, the Vilna Gaon is advocating gradual extremism, meaning to say, you eventually have to put yourself in an extreme situation for a while, but you do it through adequate training and preliminaries. So it's not a contradiction. You gradually get yourself to the other extreme, and then you're able to work yourself back in the middle. All right, so these are kind of the very, very general, we might call them the meta principles, that the Gra uses throughout. And again, some of them are, I mean, maybe most of them are not necessarily his own invention, but he sees them in Chazal, and he sees them, of course, in his interpretation of these various verses. There's one other principle the Vilna Gaon says, again, which is fascinating because it sounds like a Hasidic principle. On one hand, I gave you the statement that the most important goal of life, the goal of life, is to repair our midos. But there's another passage in the commentary where he says the goal of Torah and mitzvos is to develop within our personalities the midah of bitachon. That the goal of life, of Torah, of mitzvos, is that we should feel a relationship with God, be aware of God's love, to have trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to have emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore emunah is the greatest of all characteristics, and that is the goal of the Torah. Now, mystically, we don't always understand how, by learning Hilchos Shabbos, am I building my bitachon, right? It's not always a clear cause and effect, but the Vilna Gaon says, as a matter of spirituality, one's connection to Torah and mitzvos will inevitably connect you to God and give you a greater sense of bitachon in life. What is the difference between emunah and bitachon? So it's been said, the Ramban writes, that emunah is theory and bitachon is practice. Emunah, I believe in God, I know there's a God, I know He runs the world, I know He takes care of the world. That's in your head. But bitachon is when emotionally you feel calm and serene and accepting, and you really feel and internalize that whatever happens to me, no matter how difficult, is coming for a reason and for a purpose. And I accept it, not necessarily with the joy of dancing on the table, but with the quiet serenity of knowing Gamzu L'Tova. That is bitachon. Bitachon, and well, emunah is not easy either, but the truth of the matter is bitachon is the next level of internalizing the theoretical emunah that a person would have. And the Gaon says that is the tachlis of the of the Torah. Now I see, it's so interesting. Okay, maybe I shouldn't say this. But it's so interesting that among Lishpashir Rosh Hashivas, this idea was so difficult to accept that they say, well, the Gra can't mean that. Because obviously learning Torah is the purpose of life. Well, so they fetch around, so they offered, I've seen like artificial interpretations of the statement, but I see no reason why we need to twist the statement around. The Vilna Gaon says the purpose of Torah and mitzvot is to give a person bitachon. That's what he says, and why do I have to say that he means something different than that? So that is the importance of bitachon and the like. Okay. Now, Mishlei, of course, is a biblical book. Most of it was written by Shlomo HaMelech. We did discuss the possibility of other authors, such as Agur bin Yochai, and the mysterious King Lemuel, who is the author of Eshes Chayil. Again, Rashi learns these are pseudonyms of Shlomo, but the Vilna Gaon says these are separate people. There's also a reference to Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda having an input in the book of Mishlei. But Mishlei does introduce the idea of Musar. Now, if we go forward in the 19th century, we have a movement that was called the Musar Movement, or in Hebrew, Tenuat HaMusar. And the founder of the Musar Movement was the great Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And one needs to know a little bit about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter lived in the early and middle 19th century. He was nifter around the 1880s. And he was a brilliant Eloi. He was a genius. His father himself was a great Talmud Chacham. In fact, it's interesting, people don't know that in the back of the standard Vilna Shas, there are commentaries from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's father. They're one of the commentaries that every Shas has. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter started off life, you might say, as a conventional Gadol B'Torah. Conventional. Gadol B'Torah is not conventional, but he was a brilliant master of the Shas and the Shulchan Aruch. But then he decided that he wanted to take a different direction in his life. And it's always a bit mysterious. What was the epiphany, if I could use that word? What was the thing that made him change his direction? It's a bit shrouded in mystery, but this is the story that some people have pierced together. Because of his tremendous brilliance, and he was a truly brilliant person, he was asked to be a Rosh Yeshiva of a yeshiva in Vilna. But unbeknownst to him, his appointment as Rosh Yeshiva meant that some existing Rosh Yeshiva was asked to leave. And he didn't know that till after he accepted the position. And when he had seen how much machlokas there was, how much bickering, how much jealousy, how much rivalry, how much lashon hara, this is before the Chafetz Chaim. This is before the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim had a similar story, actually, why he became so interested in the laws of Lashon Hara. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter decided he didn't want the position at all. And he saw, in the 19th century, in that tekufa, a breakdown even among Talmidei Chachamim of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, of Midos, of caring. He saw a certain gaiva, a certain arrogance in the world. He saw among Balabatim dishonesty in business. Small things. And he said he wanted to dedicate his life to recreate these ideas of Tikkun Hamidos, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, Yiras Hashem, because if you had Yiras Hashem, you wouldn't do any of these things. And as a result, he created what is called the Musar Movement, but the Musar Movement was meant to operate on many, many, many levels. First and foremost, for Bnei Torah and Shivos and Kolo, and by the way, he started the first Kolo. As you want to say, and Kolo, I mean, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was the inventor, whether you like this or not, he was the inventor of a Kolo that would support people. That was the Kovna Kolo. This Kovna was a big city in Lithuania and the like. But, so for the yeshivos, they would learn, the Sifrei Musar, and they would be ma'ayin in them, and they would study them. But he also created for balabatim, for business people, people who were not learned. And I don't mean necessarily rich business people, tailors and shoemakers, and most of the very small businessmen, peddlers, that there would be special houses called Beis Musar. they have in Yerushalayim, Beis Musar, where you come in and you study about midos and improving yourself and the like. And as I mentioned last week, Rabbi Sol Salanter really said there were three different structural elements of the Tnuas HaMusar. One was Iyun, in which you study the great philosophical and ethical works of Judaism that go back, either starting from Mishlei, but including Shaarei Tshuva, Mesilas Yesharim. These are all Svarim that were written before Rabbi Sol Salanter. These were part of our Torah literature. And you delve into them, and you study them, and you learn them, the same way you would learn Be'ian, the laws of Shabbos, and the laws of Kashrus. You would study the halachos of Bein Adam L'Chaveira. As a matter of halacha, what does it mean not to revenge, not to take vengeance? So that's the intellectual part of Musar. That is called Musar Be'ion. There's a second part called Musar, again, and I'm repeating, but I'm going to go on to something new in a few moments. Musar Behispalos, Hispa'alut, He, Sof, Pe, Ayin, Lamed, Vav, Sof. That means Musar with emotional arousal. And that would be, and this is some conventional Gedolim thought this was nuts, but this is what he advocated, that you take a Mamar Chazal that speaks to you, and you say it over hundreds and hundreds of times, till it's almost a hypnotic trance. Huh? You pick a Mamar Chazal, a statement of Chazal, that inspires you, and you say it over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times till it penetrates your heart. This is a mantra. So it might be like Pirkei Avos. Look at three things and you will not come to sin. Me'ayin, right? They say it at Levaya today in Yerushalayim, right? Me'ayin basa. From where do you come? You're a rancid drop. Ula'ana taholech, and where are you going? Lamaka mafar rima visaylea, to a place of dirt and worms. Lifne miyata asid litang din v'cheshbon, and in front of whom are we going to give an accounting? And a person would say that over and over and over again. Or the statement in Pirkei, really any statement in Pirkei Avos would do the job. One who doesn't learn is chayav misa. Sometimes the statements are a bit, depressing and the like. But this is his palos. You would say it, you would say it, you would say it. They say Rabbi Sol Salanter once gave a hesped for a dear friend of his. And all he said, he quoted a pasuk in Koheles, that man is like a fish that is captured in a net and never knows when that net will come. It's a pasuk in Koheles. And he just said it 10 or 20 times. And everyone was sobbing and crying because of it. This is Musar Behispalos, because Rabbi Sol Salanter very much believed that intellectual understandings are not enough to change character. You need emotional arousal. And that is the Musar Behispalos. And the third component we might call a group therapy type of thing, and this is embodied today in the Musar Vad, in which people get together and they discuss their obstacles in Avodas Hashem, and each one offers a critique, because I might not be able to know whether I behaved correctly or not correctly. So my friend would critique me, and I would critique them, etc. And in that way, each would help the other. Could be a group of two people, could be a group of five people, whatever it would be. Now you understand that in yeshivas today, although we say Rabbi Sol Salanter is followed, Musar is extremely attenuated. Number one, attenuated. That means... I don't remember. No, it's reduced. It's reduced. It's much smaller. Because... number one, the only thing they do in most yeshivas is they spend a little bit of time learning a Musar book. Musar Behispalos is not done at all. And in most yeshivas, not all, the idea of a Vad also does not exist. Maybe a theoretical Vad, but even the Vad just turns into another shir. That's not, Rabbi Sol Salanter was not envisioning a Vad, let's have a shir in Mesilas Yesharim. Avad is when you get personal. You get uptight and personal. You discuss the issues. You know, they give you an example of Avad. Or just a Navardic was one of the Musar schools. I'll get to what Navardic was precisely. And Navardic emphasized that you have to be honest enough to admit that you're incorrect. And they pointed out it's very difficult for a person to say, I'm wrong. So two guys were learning, and they were arguing over the pshat in a Tosfos. Each one was saying, this is the pshat, and this one was saying, this is the pshat. So at the end, the person said to the other one, you know, you're right, your pshat is correct. Says, no! It's not enough to say, I'm right. You must say the words, you are wrong. You must be willing to say, you are wrong. And the person said, what are you bothering me? I said, you're right, let's go on. No. It's hard, it's even hard physically to say, I am wrong. I am mistaken. Or the way we apologize sometimes. You know, I'm sorry you were hurt. Now, having done that many times myself, I don't want to sit in judgments on anyone. But you understand, I'm sorry you were hurt is a way that we distance ourselves from being the cause of pain. Like, you know, you're too sensitive and you overreacted, so, you know, I guess I should have known that. As opposed to saying, I did something very, very wrong. Right? These sound like little things, foolish things, inconsequential things. But the Musar Vaz demanded that you be honest with yourself. And that sometimes is painful. And the deepest friendships were created by that honesty. Because when friends help each other grow, in fact, that is, in a marriage, that is the highest level of marriage. One can have a good marriage without reaching that highest level, but the highest level of a marriage is when each one can honestly, out of love and support, help the other person become a better person. It's not always easy, but that is the idea here. So that is the Musar Vaz. So Baruch Hashem, in recent years, Musar Vazim have started coming back. So it's coming back. But as I say, the Yisrael Salanter in the yeshiva world is essentially a hollow victory. I mean, people will say, oh, every yeshiva has Musar. Well, that is almost true. I mean, even that is not 100% true. Brisk, for example, does not have a Musar Seder. But every yeshiva does have a Musar Seder. But a Musar Seder is a pale shadow and imitation of Rabbi Yisrael's revolutionary program, which incorporated both intellectual learning and emotional arousal and the equivalent of psychoanalysis, as it were. One rule about the Musar Vaz is very interesting, and this is a rule even today in a lot of Vadim, is that you focus on small issues, not necessarily big issues. So, for example, in a woman's Musar Vaz today, to give you a contemporary example, a woman might come in and say, you know, my child spilled the milk this morning, and I yelled at her. And how do I get over, you know, what do I do? How do I improve myself in that area? Now, if, God forbid, somebody has a sister that has cancer, that is not discussed in the Musar Vaz. The theory is that if you work on small things, you are getting the spiritual resources to be able to deal with the big things. But if you let the small things slide, then when, God forbid, you really need the resources, they're not going to be there. And that is why, really, Musar is very, very demanding. It is almost like a zero-tolerance policy in which again, and that's why the Chazanish was a little against it. The Chazanish said, there may be, it's fascinating, there may be a tendency in Musar towards depression, simply because you're constantly scrutinizing. On the other hand, there are Baalei Musar who disagreed with the Chazanish. They said, fakert, the other way around. By this constant looking at your life, you have a sense of joy and purpose because you're working on growing, even though you're aware. So again, the bottom line answer to this is simply, I would have to say, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, meaning to say, there are personalities for which this is an absolutely good, healthy, wonderful approach. There are personalities who need to go away from it. I mean, you may know Rabbi Reisman from Flatbush, right? He gives the world's biggest cheer, I think. His like over 1,000 people, 1,500 people, whatever. So he comes to Yerushalayim every summer. In fact, he teaches in Har Sameach. He comes every summer here for a few weeks. He once said that Rav Pam, the great Rav Pam, told Rabbi Reisman not to learn Mesilas Yesharim, which is considered to be the greatest of the Musar Svarim, because Rabbi Reisman was such a conscientious person that these high standards would make him very depressed. There actually was. So this is an interesting question, but be it as it may, I'm trying to go over what the Musar movement is as opposed to going over every other movement. There are different movements in Klal Yisrael. But again, this fits the Gra, Chanoch Lenar, Al Pi Darko. Now, Rabbi Saul Salanter, his initial base, was in Vilna. That's where Salanter is, near Vilna, that's where he was. And his initial students were all great, great Talmidei Chachamim. They were Gedolei Torah. But for most of his life, he decided he would go to areas where there was very few religious Jews. France and Germany, which was in the grip of the Reform movement. He was a one-man outreach, Kirov operation, before Kirov was well known. And every few months, and sometimes every few years, he would go back to Vilna to his beloved learned students to give them chizuk and to get chizuk himself. But most of the time, he was a lone operator, a lone gon and tzaddik, without a yeshiva, without a kollel, without a kehila. He would just go to different cities in Germany, and he would try to teach them the Aleph Beis, he would teach them the basics of Emunah. And in many ways, he was very unusual, because he didn't want to get money for teaching Torah. So at various times, he tried to teach himself a trade. At one point, he became a stockbroker. At another point, he became a printer, and the like. But he gave all of that up because he said the halachos that are involved in being a businessman are much more complicated than the halachos of being a rav. So eventually he decided he would have to take his support that way. He commissioned a translation of the Babylonian Talmud into German, which did not succeed, but he tried to do that. We have some evidence, we know that he had a meeting with Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, and he wanted Rav Hirsch's writings to be translated in Yiddish for the Jews in Russia, because he thought it would help them, and the like. Another example, in Königsberg, which is a German city on the North Sea. So the longshoremen were all Jewish, just like in Salonika, the longshoremen were Jewish. But unlike Salonika, where the port was closed on Shabbos, in Königsberg the port was open on Shabbos. In other words, the longshoremen were mechallelei Shabbos. Rav Yisrael Salanter taught them how they could unload their cargo with a shinoi, a little bit, and in that way they would knock down the Torah prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. Things like that. Just to tell you one thing about, there's so many stories, one can give you hundreds and hundreds of stories of his sensitivity, of his kindness. I'll just give you one little story, which is a big story really. He died poverty-stricken in France, and he shared an attic garret with an old man who was also like a beggar. And in his final moments, he saw that the old man was afraid of being alone with a corpse. So he spent his last few moments on earth, not with meditation and not with vidui and not with tshuva, but just telling the man, there's nothing to be scared of. A human body is just a body. Don't worry about it. Things will be okay. The Chevra Kadisha will come. They'll take me. They'll bury me. Nothing to be scared of, you know. And he felt that the idea of comforting a scared old man was more important than whatever final preparations one would make as they would leave the world. So he was not a conventional Rosh Yeshiva. As I say, he did not have a yeshiva. He could have been a Rosh Yeshiva. But, as I say, his program was controversial. Now, nobody's against having good midos. Right? I mean, people were, hey, you're trying to give us good midos. We don't want that. But they were against the techniques, they were against the hispilus, they were against the group sessions, they were against, in the yeshivas, the amount of time this takes. There was a belief, which the Vilna Gaon, I think, would himself disagree, that learning Torah itself will improve midos. Why do we need, structure? Why are we changing the Masorah? So he did have a lot of opposition. And what he had to do is he went from town to town, in addition to his kirov activities, he was trying to convince people in learned communities of the importance of this Musar and the like. So the story goes that in order to do this, he had to show that he was a Talmud Chacham, because in Lithuania, if all you were a charismatic, emotional speaker, you didn't get very far. That's why Chabad was the only Hasidus that succeeded in Lithuania, because Chabad traditionally was a very learned and intellectual Hasidus. Right, Litvaks don't go for emotion. So he would have to show that he was a great scholar in traditional learning, and he would put up Mara Makomos, and on Shabbos he would give a big shir, a pilpul shir. So the story goes that one time he put up Mara Makomos for a pilpul shir, and somebody who wanted to discredit him switched the Mara Makomos and put up unrelated references. And Rav Soslanter comes to the shul, and he sees a piece of paper that has all different references, nothing to do with his shir. And the story goes, he turned white, and he looked at the sheet for 20 seconds, and then he gave a shir based on all of those references right then. So his great Talmud, Rav Petterberg, I'll talk about him in a moment, said, don't think he needed 20 seconds. He didn't need any time at all. But the 20 seconds where he made a, it was a Musar question. If I do this, people will think I'm such a genius that I'm making myself a Baal Gaiva. Am I allowed to express Gaiva in order to spread the Shita of Musar? And that took 20 seconds to work out in his head. It was the ethical problem. It was not the learning problem. Okay. Now, Rav Yisrael Salanter, as I say, was very involved in with non-religious Jews. By the way, it was a bit of a tragedy. His own son, well, he had some children who were religious, but one of his sons became a non-religious Jew. And he became a very famous professor of mathematics, which was uncommon for a Jew at the time in Poland. And the family name is Lipkin, Rabbi Israel Lipkin. Lipkin is the family, Salander is the city. And there is in trigonometry the Lipkin parallelogram. I'm not sure what it is. I mean, I don't think you need someone to invent a parallelogram, but whatever it is, it's a certain formula regarding the computation of volumes and areas. And his own son was not religious. Now, you have to know that in this tekufa, there is a movement called the Haskalah, which is the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was pressing Jews to have secular education, secular culture. Some maskilim were religious. You might call them modern Orthodox, so to speak. Other maskilim were kofrim. They were abikorsim. They didn't want... So the maskilim used to make an argument. One of their arguments was that you see religious Jews don't have midos. They're rude. They don't know how to behave with people. They're uncivilized. They're uncouth. So in many ways, at least historically, the Musar movement was designed as a mechanism of fighting the Haskalah indirectly by raising the refinement of the Jews. Now the truth of the matter is, though, the Maskilim wanted to use Rav Yisrael Salanter to their advantage by saying, you see, here you have an Orthodox rabbi who's a rebel against his community, implying that there is such a defect in the community. And they tried to portray Rav Yisrael Salanter as a quasi-Maskil who agreed with them. And they had the effrontery to put an ad in a Yiddish paper saying, we want to congratulate Rav Yisrael Salanter for having a son who went to the university, who left the dark walls of the yeshiva, who adopts a more modern way of life. We know that this is a product of the beautiful Jewish education that he got from his father. You see what they were trying to do. So he put in an ad. Imagine how painful this was. He put in an ad in the paper saying, my son going to university and leaving the mitzvot is very, very painful to me. And I cry over this every night. And if anyone can have any influence on my son to bring him back to the derech of the Torah, this would give me such tremendous joy. And he felt he had to kind of embarrass himself that way, that he shouldn't be used as a poster boy for the Haskalah ideology. Interestingly enough, consistent with his approach to the longshoremen, in which even though, see, some people might say, hey, if these people are desecrating Shabbos, why should I be the one that tells them how to minimize their desecration? There is such a philosophy. But he said, no. Even if somebody is sinning, if you teach them how to make it less of an Aveira, that's a good thing. He wrote to his son, if you're going to have treif, better to have treif beef, which is from a kosher animal, even though it wasn't shechted, than to have pork, which is behemoth tamea. So he gave him a hierarchy. If you're going to transgress, do it this way, and not that way. By the way, this has very interesting repercussions to digress on my digression on my digression. This is a shaila that Rabbanim have to face today, and I'm not going to give you psak, obviously there's no reason for me to paskin on this here. And that is, let's say you're a Rav, and a couple comes to you, and they're not married. They're not married. They are living out of wedlock. They are living in sin, as we say. But the problem is, if the woman doesn't go to the mikvah, and the man is living with the woman as a nida, that is an aveira for which the Torah says the chiyuv is kares. If, on the other hand, the single woman goes to the mikvah, so it's still prohibited, it is a negative commandment to live outside of marriage, but you've downgraded the prohibition from a very, very severe chiyuv kares to a much lower level of aveira. Would it be proper to tell a couple, if you are not getting married and you're going to be living together anyway, go to the mikvah to take off the nida status? Or do we say, wait a second here, that means the Rav is giving a hechsher and an approval and a legitimation of a sinful union. It seems from Yisrael Salanter, perhaps, although I don't want to extrapolate as a definitive rule, that Yisrael Salanter basically says that you try to minimize prohibitions as much as possible. If he's telling his son, eat treif beef instead of pork, he's not legitimating the eating of treif. He's simply saying it's less of an aveira. So it's an interesting thing. And again, some rabbanim actually have done this. Some rabbanim will certainly not allow it publicly. They will not say mikvah open for single. You don't do something publicly, but privately. Sometimes some rabbanim do paskin that way. Other rabbanim say absolutely not. So, and I'm not giving you a psak, but this is kind of the issue. How do you deal with people that are sinning, who are going to continue to sin, but you have a way to make it less of an aveira? Do you basically say, no, I'm not going to do that? Or do you say, I try to minimize the aveira to whatever degree possible? Was there a yeah?
Did he just eat meat, or did he
also? I don't know. I don't know a lot about. In fact, we know relatively. We don't even have a picture of Yisrael Salanter, interestingly enough. And I don't know why. I don't know why we don't have a picture. I mean, cameras were around then, but he was such a private person in many, many ways. Derech Agav, it seems he also suffered from very severe depression. But in those days, it was not a medical condition, so to speak. So he just lived with it. I mean, he did everything he did in spite of that tremendous depression that he sometimes had. He also had children who were big Talmidei Chachamim. So in fact, there's a general, a retired general, Lipkin in Israel. He is Lipkin Shachar, I think it is. Yeah, yeah. He is a direct descendant of Yisrael Salanter. I don't know from which child. He does have, relatives that are still alive today. And of course, so many stories. The story about Yisrael Salanter said, a person's face is like a public thoroughfare, meaning to say, you're not allowed to block a road, right? Because you're impeding access. So if a person has problems and a person is frowning or unhappy, says, you don't have the right to project that on other people. And all of the stories, once he was ill and his Talmidim were baking matzah for Pesach, and they asked him, what halacha should we follow about matzah, all of the chumras? And he said, the most important halacha to follow is don't be hard on the almana that is baking the matzah, that is kneading the dough. Or I think I mentioned, I'm not sure if I mentioned this story, forgive me, but I don't think I did, about he once came to somebody's a Talmid's house on Shabbos when he was wandering around, and he told the Talmid said, you're going to love my house, we have Zemiros between the courses and Torah between the courses, and our Shabbos Suda is 4 hours Friday night. It's really a wonderful, really aesthetic experience. And Rabbi Saul said, I will come to you on the condition that from Kiddush to benching will be a half an hour. He says, no more than a half an hour meal. So the Talmud didn't understand it, but they were just rushing, you know, you wash, Kiddush, eat, yes, clean, get out the dishes, bench in a half an hour. So the Talmud, who was a very wealthy person, just didn't understand what was going on. So Rabbi Saul said, can I speak to the cook in the kitchen? He was rich enough that, you know, he had a cook. And the cook came out, and Rabbi Saul said to the cook, I want to apologize. I know that you normally have plenty of time to prepare the meal, and I rushed you, and I'm sorry. And the cook said, Rebbe, this is the greatest Friday night I have ever had in my life. I'm a widow, and I have a 12-year-old son at home. And normally I'm here in the house here till 1 o'clock in the morning, and my son waits for me. And at 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, we have a little meal together, and I never have a chance to spend time with my child. Now, for the first time in 10 years, I can go and have a suda with my child. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hashem should bless you. Rabbi Solanter looked at the person and said the famous words that everybody knows that he always said, you don't be a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon. This was it. And the stories in which he emphasized this point, I mean, they're so familiar and so many, you can go on and on and on, that, you know, the Gemara says when you wash your hands before bread, you're supposed to use a lot of water. And the more water you use, it's a siman bracha. But in those days, before indoor plumbing, there would be people who would have to bring water from the well. So when he would be washing his hands, when there was someone who had to bring the water, he would only use the bare minimum. He says, who am I? I'm going to cause them to have to bring more water in? Right? This was the idea. His Talmud, Rav Simcha Zissel, said that Charles Darwin recently wrote the book, The Origin of Species, which is the theory of evolution, in which man is descended from ape. The Altar of Kelim once said, and again, I'll tell you who these people are because you need to know these people. One said that Charles Darwin thought man came from ape because he never met my Rebbe. If he would have met my Rebbe, he would have known only Hashem could have made such a person. This person could not come from an animal in any possible way. This is Rabbi Saul Solanter. But as I say, in this lifetime, there was some controversy. Not everybody accepted it. I think everyone, as far as I know, considered him to be a great, exceptional tzaddik. Nobody, unlike Rav Kook, who was personally maligned, that itself was a travesty. I don't believe anyone maligned Rav Yisrael Solanter, but his ideas were considered to be very, very radical. It's interesting that towards the end of his life, the Chafetz Chaim, who was a young man, wrote his book on Shmiras HaLashon. And Rabbi Saul Solanter looked at that book on Shmiras HaLashon and said, Baruch Hashem, Hashem has given a new person who will help people in refining their midos. But it's interesting, I mean, we may have spoken about this, there is one machlokas. It says Rabbi Saul Solanter read the laws of Lashon Hara as codified by the Chafetz Chaim, and he disagreed with one halacha. There was one law that he paskened differently, and this is a very practical law. Let's say, right, if I hurt you, I normally, before Yom Kippur, I have to ask your forgiveness. I have to tell you what I did and ask your forgiveness, and then you're mochil me, assuming I'm sincere. What if I spoke Lashon Hara about you and you don't know? Am I supposed to tell you, oh, I said something really bad about you, I want to ask your forgiveness? The Chafetz Chaim says we treat Lashon Hara the same way as anything else. I must go over to you and say, I'm really, really sorry. I said something very nasty about you, and you have the right to ask me, what did I say? And I have to tell you. Then I ask your mechila. This is what the Chafetz Chaim says. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, doesn't work. Because if you have to tell the person the bad, negative thing you said about them, you're going to hurt them more by telling them. And once again, you want mechila, so you're going to ask mechila, you're going to get forgiveness from Hashem by hurting a person and by humiliating them. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter paskins that you don't. If the person is not aware, and the person, and you know, there's no way they would be aware of this, it is better for you not to tell them. Now, who do you paskin like? It's a practical question. So they say in the name of Rav Aaron Cutler that although the Chafetz Chaim is considered to be the preeminent authority on the laws of Lashon Hara, but when it comes to Bein Adam L'Chaveiro generally, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is even a more definitive posek. So we follow Rabbi Saul Salanter's view in this particular area. Okay, so this is a little bit about Rabbi Saul Salanter and the movement that is called the Musar movement. Now, the thing is that Rabbi Saul Salanter had many, many students, but in the Vilna area, he had students who were really themselves great Gedolei Torah. And he had, which you might, five main students. Three of them became founders of yeshiva systems, and two of them really kind of were outside of the yeshiva framework. The three great students that founded yeshiva systems were, they all went by the appellation Alter, the old man of. There are three Alters involved here. The most senior disciple, who was with him for the longest, was the Alter of Kelim. Kelim is just a city in Lithuania. That is Rav Simcha Zissel Brody. Simcha Zissel Brody. His great-great-grandson, by the exact same name, was the Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron here in Israel. He died a few years ago. Rav Simcha Zissel Brody, or sometimes the name is Ziv. Again, in that tekufa, last names are always being changed for army or whatever it is. So it's either Simcha Zissel Ziv or Simcha Zissel Brody. The name seems to have been go back and forth. There. He is called the Alter of Kelim. The next student is the Alter of Slobodka, Rav Nasan Svi Finkel, the same name as the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, who was his great-grandson. And the third was Rav Yosef Yozel Horowitz, the Alter of Nevardak. So what I'm going to do next time is I want to just briefly show you that part of the greatness of Yisrael Salanter is that each of these three students had a radically different idea of what Musar was about. There is Kelim Musar, there is Slobodka Musar, there is Nevardak Musar. And we'll talk about that. But the two students who were outside the Musar system were Rev Yitzchak Blazer, that's his last name, who was the Rav of Petersburg, Russia. And he is called Rav Itzela Petterberger, but he's Rav Yitzchak Blazer. And the other one was a person who was a Rav in Helsinki, Finland, of all people. But he retired from that position to run a bakery in Kovna. And he became a baker, and that is Rav Naftali Amsterdam. Now, both of those two were very connected to the Slobodka Yeshiva, but not in an official capacity. Okay, so those I would think, it's hard to generalize, there were many other Talmidim as well, but these are the big five, and we'll talk about them next time. So have a good week.